The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Just before we hear from Nick Ferrari at Westminster, let's hear a little bit of the Labour Party leader, Keir Starmer, the new British Prime Minister, how he addressed the British nation for the first time on the steps of 10 Downing Street.
Our country has voted decisively for change, for national renewal and a return of politics to public service. When the gap between the sacrifices made by people and the service they receive from politicians grows this big, it leads to a weariness in the heart of a nation, a draining away of the hope, the spirit, the belief in a better future, that we need to move forward together. Now, this wound, this lack of trust, can only be healed by actions, not words. I know that. But we can make a start today with the simple acknowledgement that public service is a privilege and that your government should treat every single person in this country with respect.
Nick Ferrari, presenter Nick Ferrari at Breakfast on LBC Radio, is with us from Westminster. And Nick, he spoke there about the British people speaking decisively. But it's a rather strange system, isn't it, that gives a party such a landslide majority, about two-thirds of the seats in the House of Commons, and about one-third of the vote.
Bonkers is how some people would describe it, Matt. Good evening to you and your listeners, and apologies if it's a bit noisy. I'm two streets back from Downing Street. We have a political system where, let's just bear this in mind, the Labour Party now are in with a second record majority. It's 170-something. Why do I say that? Because there's a ferocious count still going on in Essex. But they're not going to be, they're going to be a couple behind 179, which is their world record under Tony Blair. But they're 170-something. But just let your listeners ponder on this. The last time Britain went to the polls, the Labour Party got 33% of the vote. Today they got 35% of the vote, but they are in with a majority of 170-plus. This is the extraordinary, as you've just referenced, the extraordinary vagaries of the so-called first-past-the-post British system, which, by the way, if you look at a party such as Reform, they got 4.5 million votes, they get four candidates, and the Greens, who got 4 million votes, and they get four candidates. It's a strange world.
It is, and then you look at the Lib Dems, who I think got less votes than the Reform Party, and who end up with 71 seats.
Exactly right. If you look at those and you do all the projections, they should be nowhere near that. But this is what you have with the first past the post. So what are the advantages? You look at a country such as Belgium, which in the past has had elections, and I think it's taken something like 10 years to find out, not literally, who's going to be the actual leader of the party. So we're kind of embedded in this. But to your point, we're now looking at a Liberal Democrat Party that has a record number of seats, 79 from memory, or 80. You're looking at Reform. Well, the clue there is in the name of the party. They've got four. There is a sense that the way it is currently constituted, the way people vote and the responses, has to change. But taking nothing away from Labour, as you rightly say, it is a thumping, absolutely whopping majority, second highest ever on record.
But what are they going to do with it? Because the one thing that was noticeable from the campaign was how little Keir Starmer and the Labour Party gave away as to what they would do if they got power.
You've nailed it. God knows I tried. People from the BBC tried. People from other broadcast agencies and newspapers tried. We know very little. So the reason I'm still in Westminster now is because I'm watching the various shadow ministers go in now who are being appointed, the ministers, the secretaries of state, and we await their briefs and their decisions. What it is all hinged on this, the one thing that all of them spoke like an absolute mantra, is this were the plans they have, the ambitions they have to put a country right. A country that, by the way, is in enormous problems. The NHS waiting list is an all-time high. Dissatisfaction with the NHS at an all-time high, polluted water. I'll stop there, but I could go everywhere. They say they can solve it. How are they going to do it? Because they're going to get money from growth. So a lot of pressure on the Chancellor. We wait and we see. They were pressed so many times about will there be increases in capital gain tax, inheritance tax, whatever. They refuse to answer the questions. So there are some people waiting nervously.
Starmer comes across as a decent, well-intentioned man. But what about his political skills? Because there are people who say that they should not be underestimated given the job that he did in taking control of the Labour Party back from Jeremy Corbyn and making Labour electable.
I've been incredibly fortunate. Sir Keir Starmer has done phone-ins on the radio station I work in for 4 years. The only station he's done that for, and I've seen him by and large every other month. He is the consummate politician. He had a real difficult time when bear in mind, when he got the job, we were in lockdown. So for 18 months, in some instances, he couldn't even physically meet his members or the people to whom he was speaking. He had to do it via video link. He has cleansed the party of what was undoubtedly a nasty anti-Semitic sense. He's done brilliantly there. We read that he, and I think it's true, he's a supremely skilled barrister. He is apparently ready for confrontation. But if you look back at the campaign, Matt, I take you back, 4 weeks or so, and there was a heck of a row about a veteran Labour politician called Diane Abbott. And for about 24 hours, Diane Abbott, who was the first ever black female MP in the United Kingdom, she seemed to be controlling the party more than Keir Starmer. So we are about to see, but it is a huge task on his hands. And you know, as a political expert, sometimes actually, bizarrely, a large majority can perversely be a hindrance.
Yes, because you have more people looking for jobs and you have more dissatisfied people when they don't get positions. Let's move on to the Tories, though, and let's just hear the former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, announce that as a result of this humiliating defeat, he's stepping down as leader of the Conservative Party.
To the country, I would like to say first and foremost, I am sorry. I have given this job my all, but you have sent a clear signal that the government of the United Kingdom must change, and yours is the only judgment that matters. I have heard your anger, your disappointment, and I take responsibility for this loss. Following this result, I will step down as party leader. Not immediately, but once the formal arrangements for selecting my successor are in place. It is important that after 14 years in government, the Conservative Party rebuilds, but also that it takes up its crucial role in opposition professionally and effectively.
Would it be fair, Nick, to say that over the 14 years, the Conservatives became increasingly incompetent, that they got riven as well by their position in relation to leaving the European Union, and then as a result they left the door open for reform to effectively nobble the chances of re-election for many of the MPs who've lost their seats overnight?
Broadly speaking, yes. I would point to one possible highlight. The United Kingdom didn't do badly in getting a vaccine out to try and combat COVID. I'm not buying the argument, by the way, that Rishi Sunak put out, we had COVID, we've had this, we had Ukraine. Right. Much of Europe, well, the entire world, by the way, had COVID. Much of Europe has had Ukraine to deal with. But did the United Kingdom get their vaccine out quickly? Yes, they did. But to your broader point, it has not been enough. You point to too many failures. The grotesque waste of billions of pounds, and I'm telling you, tens of billions of pounds on PPE kit that was never used. What looks like, I stress, what looks like backhanders to Conservative donors who did quite well out of it. People partying when some of their constituents were dying. This is a very ugly mood or sense to move away from, and I sense that's what's Mr. Sunak, which, in fairness to him, he was Chancellor then. He was fined, by the way, as a Chancellor going to a party, but he was Chancellor. That is what he's paying for.
Okay, Labour has a big majority, so there are lots of things it might be able to do with that majority. But beneath that, could it be that Britain faces a very difficult number of years because of the level of public dissatisfaction with politics? Given that the turnout at the election was as low as 60%, down about 7.3% on the last election, given that you've had parties like the Conservatives broken in two almost, and the surge of the reform movement, the SNP in Scotland also in crisis as it loses most of its MPs. Independent independents winning seats in a few locations by taking on Labour in relation to its Palestinian position. Does this all give the feeling of a country in flux?
The political plates are undoubtedly shifting, Matt. The SNP goes down to just 9 MPs, which is quite extraordinary. To your broader point, where are we with the interest in voting? Let me tell you, the turnout is 60%. That is the second lowest since 1885. That gives you an indication. And it's not as if people aren't feeling angry and they want to try and do something about the general election. So people are feeling the pain. They want to try and act on the pain, and yet they still haven't come out and vote. So that is something that has to be addressed by all parties. And as Professor Sir John Curtis, who is the United Kingdom's leading poll expert for sophologists, pointed to, this turnout is truly extraordinary. And if you factor Scotland out of the turnout, actually for the rest of the United Kingdom, it drops down to the low 50%.
Thank you very much, Nick Ferrari, presenter of Nick Ferrari at Breakfast on LBC Radio. Let's go north to Amanda Ferguson. Amanda, had anyone seen it coming that Ian Paisley Jr. would lose his seat?
No, perhaps Jim Allister from the TUV did, but no, it wasn't something that was being talked up by anybody. I think that there was a sense that the DUP could drop 3 seats on a bad day, but it felt like Gavin Robinson, the DUP leader, was more in jeopardy in East Belfast than Ian Paisley was in North Antrim. So the TUV's breakthrough at Westminster has been a sensational result for Jim Allister.
Yeah, what went wrong for Ian Paisley Jr.? How has he gone out of favour, given the dynasty that he's part of?
Well, I think that he's perhaps not as in touch with the constituency as he might have been in previous years when he lived there. He's also been embroiled in a few different controversies at Westminster. And then also there was a sense that people didn't like Ian Paisley perhaps gloating that Nigel Farage had backed him over Jim Allister, and TUV was supposed to have this link up with Reform where they were sort of fielding joint candidates. And then Nigel Farage came out and said that he was personally backing Ian Paisley and also Sammy Wilson in East Antrim. So I think there's been a few different interesting results that have come through from the North over the last 24 hours. Certainly the fact that Sinn Féin is now the largest party of Westminster means it's done the hat trick as such, that it's the largest party of local government of Stormont and now of Westminster. The DUP took 5 seats instead of the 8 that it won last time, but those other 3 seats either went to Alliance or to other unionists. So there's still 8 unionist MPs. It's just the makeup of the MPs has changed significantly. Now, the Alliance Party have also got sort of mixed fortunes in that they lost Stephen Farry in North Down. The deputy leader for the party didn't retain that seat in North Down. However, Saoirse Eastwood made a breakthrough in Lagan Valley, and she's the first woman to be MP in that constituency, and she's also the first non-unionist to be MP in that constituency. So if you look at the fortunes, you know, you can see Sinn Féin will be going for Foyle and for East Derry next time. And you can see that Alliance will be going for Strangford and also East Antrim, where they came closer than anybody expected.
Is the Democratic Unionist Party in big trouble now? And is it in danger of having the same sort of problems that the Tories had because of Brexit? That with the DUP enthusiastically went along with a pro-Brexit position as if almost to prove its patriotic Britishness, but that has rebounded on itself to an extent in that it has been unable to deliver the type of Brexit that it promised its voters.
I think so. It feels like the DUP over the last decade has been engaged in self-harm and also the harm of a lot of other groups around them. So whenever the DUP was going into this election, it was under pressure on a range of fronts. First of all, it had taken a dip in the polls. Secondly, it was dealing with the fallout from its former leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, being involved in a high-profile court case. Then, of course, hardline unionists were unhappy with the post-Brexit trading arrangements, and some people were unhappy with the return to Stormont. And then because it's a Westminster election, which is first past the post, so you don't get the preference who you want, you just have to pick one person. A lot of non-unionists will have voted tactically to give the DUP a bloody nose because they've been upset with the DUP over the Stormont impasse that lasted for 2 years, and also because of DUP intransigence on a range of issues, not least the Irish language and so on. So it's a really mixed picture, and into that is the fact that it's the first July election since 1945. We know that postal and proxy votes were up and so on. So it was a real mixture of issues that have led to this result. But certainly that breakthrough for Jim Allister in North Antrim, nobody could see that coming.
And what about for Sinn Féin, given the disappointment that it had in the local and European elections south of the border? How much solace will it take from the retention of all of its seats? Or will there be disappointment that they haven't moved that bit further?
No, I think the Sinn Féin can probably be happy with what's happened. You know, as you noted there, a disappointing performance in the local and European elections on your side of the border. However, it's very much viewed that while they are an all-Ireland party and a Republican party, that because of partition, the issues that affect North and South can be very different. It's a different context that we're dealing with. So Sinn Féin has done well to retain the 7 seats that it's holding, that it held last time. And then also the fact that it nearly came close to winning the seat in East Derry, and also reduced that majority that Colm Eastwood from the SDLP has in Foyle, from you know, tens of thousands down to 4,000. So there's a lot in the mix for them to be happy about. But I guess now that they've got a local election, a Stormont election, and a Westminster election out of the way in Northern Ireland, all their focus will now shift onto the general election on your side of the border, because they realise that they've got ground to make up from their sort of disappointing performance last time.
Thank you very much, Amanda Ferguson. Daniel McConnell is joining us now, but before we talk to him, let's hear Taoiseach Simon Harris welcoming the opportunity for what he called a great reset in Anglo-Irish relations after Labour's victory.
The relationship between Ireland and the United Kingdom is deeply consequential for all people across these islands. And the relationship between an Irish Taoiseach and a British Prime Minister is vital. Today is about looking forward. It's about realising the full potential of that relationship between Taoiseach and Prime Minister and between our governments. I know that Keir Starmer and I share a desire for it to go from strength to strength. It is time for a great reset. In the Labour Party manifesto, the language towards Ireland was language of partnership and of co-guarantors of our shared peace. This morning, from Dublin, I want to send a message to London that I will match Keir Starmer's commitment and energy to our peace process and to our future potential in so many areas. I will work to make the Taoiseach Prime Minister relationship not only what it should be, but what it could be.
Daniel McConnell, I may have missed it, but I don't think there was any reference to Rishi Sunak or any of his predecessors. It was all forward-looking. Was that an implied criticism of what the Irish government has put up with from the Tory government in recent years?
No doubt about it, Matt, and certainly the mood music around this result, you know, has been there for quite some time. You know, behind the scenes, you've had a lot of engagement with the Irish government and Keir Starmer's team. And I would have thought even the British Civil Service has been kind of gearing up for a kind of this result. So I think the result was not unexpected and very clear. I think that there's a hope and a desire within the government in Dublin of that great reset, because, you know, we can think back to the high point of the Queen's visit here in 2011. But, you know, since the onset of Brexit and all of that, I mean, the relationship between Dublin and London has become incredibly strained. And that's been acknowledged publicly by the likes of Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney and others. And ultimately, I suppose what you've seen is a refusal of successive British prime ministers to take the Irish issue seriously. I think Rishi Sunak and Chris Heaton-Harris deserve some credit for, you know, their work on the Windsor framework and getting it to that point at least. I would also want to point out, I think there was a lot of work done by the Labour Party spokesperson, who I believe is likely to become the new Northern Ireland Secretary, Hilary Benn. He worked in tandem with his opposite number to try and, I suppose, cajole the DUP and others into power in Northern Ireland. So there has been a lot of work behind the scenes to try and make that work. So that's one area where I would give credit to the British government in more recent times. But overall, I think it's a relationship that has become severely damaged. So I think you could hear a very honest appraisal and, I suppose, hope by Simon Harris earlier on today, that that relationship will improve. I think it's very clear, and I would expect that there will, you know, I think it could be within the next 24 hours that the two leaders end up having a conversation. I get a sense that Simon Harris in the Taoiseach's office, given Keir Starmer's association and history with Ireland, that he will be amongst the first cadre of leaders that he will be in contact with, following his election.
Well, indeed, because the closest advisor to Keir Starmer is a Corkman from Macroom, Morgan McSweeney, whose family are very much involved in Fine Gael over the decades. But could it be that we might end up being a little bit disappointed, given that Keir Starmer would not probably take a Jeremy Corbyn line in relation to a border poll, would be far more cautious and conservative. And indeed, even this week in an interview in the Financial Times, not only did he rule out the possibility of Britain rejoining the European Union, when asked about the single market, which a lot of people see as a backdoor way to sorting issues out, he said, no, not in his lifetime.
Yeah, I think there was he's very cautious, and he has shown, I suppose, a reluctance to even open the door on the European issue even before the election. There was definitely an attempt not to spook the horses going into the election. I think he would say, and certainly, you know, when you're kind of making inquiries about that sort of issue, even to kind of British sources, they would make the point that he would have no mandate to do that. He would almost need a separate mandate to go off and try and renegotiate with the European Union, you know, in terms of the single market or the customs union. However, I think there is an expectation that there will be a definite warming of relations between Europe or between London and Brussels. And I think Ireland will be a beneficiary of that and will probably be a key player in that. I think there's a definite recognition that they're not re-entering the single market or looking to move to back into the customs union or anything like that, that's not to say that relations can't improve, and there are some tangible gains that can be won even in the short term. And I certainly think the mood music from Brussels overnight, according to our correspondent and our colleagues in Brussels overnight, is that, you know, there's generally an optimism at that most senior level within Brussels that relationship can be repaired, that the sort of nonsense carry on and sort of dysfunctionality that we've seen under successive British prime ministers in the Tory party is now at an end. And you'll see, I suppose, grown-ups returning to the table and a more pragmatic and more honest and more genuine and warm relationship kicking off again. So I will see, as I said, I expect to see Simon Harris and Keir Starmer talking in the next 24 to 48 hours. I expect to see Micheál Martin talking to his opposite number as well. And I would have no doubt that there'll be moves afoot for the leaders to meet as early as possible. I get the sense that they are scheduled to meet on the 18th of July at an event anyway. But there's, I think, a hope that they might be able to find some time to meet bilaterally, okay, even before then. But, you know, it is a significant change, and it will mark a significant sea change in the relationship between Dublin and London. There's no doubt about that.
Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.